Bene, grazie. Mi sentite? Allora, l'intervento lo faccio in inglese, va bene, perché ho scritto il paper in inglese. Thank you very much for inviting me to the conference. And this presentation is part of a book project that looks at the role played by early humanist translations in repurposing medical, botanical, and scientific knowledge in the Renaissance. I'm trying to finish right now. This was part of a fellowship at Harvard Villetatti 2 years ago, and now I'm trying to wrap this up into a book, right? So I'll start with a quotation from an old friend, someone who.
Just click on the and speak. The mouse.
Okay. So I'll start with a quotation from Angelo Poliziano, an author I studied quite a long time ago. And thinking about him, I realized that in his opening lecture on Aristotelian ethics, called the Panepistemon, right, which was delivered in the early 1490s, Poliziano adopts a taxonomical approach to classify knowledge, including not only traditional liberal and mechanical arts, but also base and manual laws, which he saw were essential to life. In a very curious passage in the introduction, he compares his method of classification to anatomical dissection. And you can read it there at the end. He says, "Imitavo sectiones illas medicorum, quas anatomas vocant." I will imitate the divisions practiced by physicians, which they call anatomical dissection. So he explained he would begin by dividing knowledge into smaller parts for easier understanding, a process he compared to both medical dissections and accounting. Poliziano's metaphor of dissection extends beyond rhetoric. It's not just a rhetorical topos. It highlights the interconnection between language and material reality, that is, res and verba, and challenges the separation of humanist and scientific knowledge. As Poliziano shows, the perceived divide between language and matter is artificial. Even the most physical act of dissecting a body involves linguistic processes as much as manual ones, right? Identifying body parts requires precise labeling, and making incisions involves a form of parsing that demands a specific syntax to determine what is included or excluded from a given section. More generally, the act of dissection is guided by a system of pre-existing associations of words and reference mapping onto the human anatomy. Moreover, during the medieval and early modern periods, anatomical dissections were often performed as speech acts in front of an audience, right? Primarily within university settings for educational purposes. In this way, as noted by Poliziano, bodily dissections closely mirror discursive ones, and advancements in one domain often necessitate adjustments in the other domain. Epistemic progress in anatomical knowledge frequently results from aligning the physical and linguistic domains into more accurate descriptions. So you can see, I brought these images. Late 15th century images, right, to show the interaction between language and body in these two medieval illustrations. So on the right, you can see an illustration from the Fasciculus Medicinae, the first printed book to contain anatomical illustrations. The image depicts a dissection. So you see the corpse is laid out on a table across a picture space, and the dissector, which is a surgeon, yesterday we heard about surgeons because they're the ones who were able to touch the body, not the physicians, leans over with a huge knife. The lecturer presides over the scene from a pulpit booth above, looking out at the viewer rather than at the corpse, and presumably reading from Galen's text. So this scene captures the relationship between language and matter in the performance of an actual dissection, right? In the university context. And the image on the left, also from a 15th century manuscript, shows an image of a human body with the corresponding labels in Latin, mapping the interaction between both membra, the language items, and the anatomical parts. I'll go now more specifically into the gist of my presentation, which concerns the 400. The late medieval period saw what I want to like to call a terminological crisis. Linguistic mismatches arose from new empirical discoveries alongside new authors, interpretations, and translations. This prompted a need for precise language to map traditional and updated anatomical knowledge across different languages and cultural contexts. I would like to argue here that the medical humanists' re-examination of Greek scientific texts, particularly through new translations into Neo-Latin or later vernacular languages, raised new questions that aligned with and possibly even stimulated empirical discoveries like anatomical investigation. Translation in the Renaissance was a hermeneutic process that reshaped scientific knowledge, including medical and anatomical understanding, through lexical innovations and the creation of new terms, which helped to reconceptualize knowledge. The revival of Greek medical texts in the West began in Italy during the late 15th century, with figures like Niccolò Nonnichedo advocating for a return to Greek sources, culminating in the Aldine editions of Galen and Hippocrates, and marking the rise of medical Hellenism. Latin humanists revisiting Greek texts developed a specialized proto-medical Latin terminology, refining and expanding the scientific lexicon as part of the broadest humanist translation agenda. Discrepancies between Greek and Latin medical terminology led to scholarly debates and collaborations aimed at achieving conceptual and terminological precision, facilitating expert communication, often through the creation of neologisms or new words, new terms. Humanist translators played a key role in standardizing or trying to standardize medical terminology by identifying obsolete vocabulary and crafting updated terms to reflect emerging medical concepts. This would eventually lead to the stabilization of medical language for a period of time. Okay, the first, I'm going to provide two examples, right, in this presentation, just two examples. The first case I'd like to look at is the what I see, I believe, is a creation of a medical term involving the urinary system. And so the term is urinarius, right? So from my research into medieval and classical Latin dictionaries and glossaries, the term urinarius does not appear. It does not appear. It was not used, right? And the Lexique de la prose latine de la Renaissance, you know, indicates that the term urinarius was first used by Vesalius, right? Which is true. If you look go to Vesalius, you see like plenty of reference uses of the term. Then I'll show you how in particular. But he makes use of this term. However. And you see there, for example, an example from the Fabrica, the Humanis Corporis Fabrica, you see at the end that he uses the adjective urinari meatus, right? To refer to what we call the ureter, right? Although he uses also for the urethra, right? For both the ureters and the urethra. However, I started wondering where this term came from, right? Where did it originate? And I managed to identify that the term had been used previously, like almost a century earlier than Vesalius, right? So he was not inventing the term. And I found in a manuscript this term. That's how it all came up, because I was reading Francesco Filelfo. Francesco Filelfo in 1444 produced the first Latin translations of two Hippocratic works or pseudo-Hippocratic works, the Flatibus and the Passionibus. And here in a section of a manuscript I was reading for other purposes, I, I, I noticed the word urinarius, right? In a section of the passage. In this case, he uses it to render diuretic medications, the Greek diureticoisin pharmakois. He uses the word urinaris to render that phrase, right? Prior to Philelphus' innovation, Latin lacked the specific terms for urinary ducts. From my research in vocabularies, references to urinary parts were generally made by using the genitive of the noun urina. So they like urine iter, right? Like the pathway of urine. There is an unusual term, urinalis, attested in a couple of works from late Latin texts, urinalis pertaining to urine, but it was a very rare term and it was practically not used at all, right? Only there are very few attestations, right? So now this term urinaris, as we see, remained dormant in manuscript until the rise of the printing press in the late 15th century, when it became more widespread, particularly in the phrase meatus urinarius, like urinary ducts, to refer both to the ureters and the urethra. So Philelphus' use of urinarius and subsequent humanist translations of Hippocratic and Galenic texts played a pivotal role in defining and standardizing medical terminology, influencing later works like Vesalius' De Fabrica in the mid 16th century. So the term urinarius first appeared in print, right? From what I can, obviously I don't know, although I did a very thorough search, but the first in all the Neo-Latin corpus, these are texts I work with, so I know them pretty well. So the first attestation of this occurrence of this term is in the 1494 edition translation of the Hippocratic Aphorisms and Galen's Commentary in 1494. This was edition you have in the middle, right? The section in the middle. This is our translation by Lorenzo Lorenzi. Multiple humanists, including Lorenzo Lorenzi and Niccolò Rinuccino, he is the one with the version on the right, and possibly also Theodore Gaza previously, translated the Hippocratic aphorisms with Galen's commentaries, further popularizing the term urinarius. If you look there, I didn't highlight it, but you see that both Lorenzi and Rinucceno use the term urinarius. And then I'll show you a more detailed. So this is a comparison, a table I produced, where you have Galen's texts in the original, and then you have the old translation by Constantine the African in the 11th century, the old translation from Arabic made in the 11th century. And then you have the new translations by the medical humanists like Lorenzi and Rinucceno. And you notice there that Constantine uses omni instrumento urine, right? And vis urine, as was the traditional use in the Latin texts. And you see the innovation by the medical humanists. They use meatibus urinaris omnibus, urinaris meatibus. So both of them use this new adjective, right? New adjective coined from Latin. And it's through the printing press that this adjective becomes popular, right? And as I'll show you later, in the 16th century, early 16th century, throughout the 16th century, this is going to be the standard term to refer to the ureters, meatus urinarius. So here I just have a couple of examples. As a result of the medical humanist retranslation of the Greek medical corpus, the denominative adjective urinarius was incorporated into the Latin lexicon. The dissemination of this Neo-Latin neologism gained momentum in the first half of the 16th century, and it was adopted by the scientific community. including prominent physicians such as Leonid Cheno, Musa Brasavola, Leonhard Fuchs, Agricola, Antonio Benedetti, Niccolò Massa, and Vesalius, among many others. So, I mean, most of these medical physicians and anatomists use the word meatus urinarius. However, and this is very interesting, the usage of the adjective soon extended beyond this periphrasis meatus urinarius. So it was used to designate mostly the ureters or the urethra. The urethra was sometimes called fistula urinaria to distinguish it, right? But then the adjective started to be used to designate the urinary pathways, more organs more generally, right? Membra urinaria, via urinaria, organa urinaria, vasus urinarius. So this is very interesting for a history of terminology and also the role played by translation in this process, right? So the case of urinarius underscores the dynamics of language change driven by the agency of expert translators. Translation should therefore be seen as a productive method of word formation and lexical building, particularly in specialized fields that require a precise terminological unit. It is possible to suggest that the coinage of this adjective urinarius contributed to a clearer conceptualization of a group of organs connected by a common function, right? Namely, the production and expression of bodily fluids. So this concept is now referred to as the urinary system, right? But we see how sometimes the creation of a word may somehow, you know, facilitate or, you know, foster even the conceptualization. So obviously, physiology, as someone said, only started in the 18th century, late 17th, 18th century. Someone mentioned that yesterday, but I mean, the presence of this adjective urinary may have helped to conceive the urinary as a system, right? As a system of interrelated organs, right? With a specific function. I'll just present another case. This is also very interesting. The case of the pharynx. This time, it does not involve the creation of a term, but the correct definition or identification of a Greek term referring to a specific organ. This word, however, was badly understood by anatomists, physicians, and medical translators alike. Again, medical humanists were involved here. Leonid Cheno, precisely, the Ferrarese physician, the one on the left, was among the first, on the right, sorry, it was the first to advocate for the expurgation of medical terminology. This was central to his treatise on the errors of Pliny, first published in Ferrara in 1492, with numerous additions in subsequent years, culminated in 1529 edition of the complete series. In this work, Leonid Cheno addresses errors made by Pliny in Materia Medica, but it also ventured into less explored areas of medical knowledge, including anatomy. In a chapter of the third book, Leonid Cheno focuses on the throat and highlights terminological errors in contemporary anatomical literature. Leonid Cheno's attack in this case was specifically aimed at the renowned pre-Vesalian anatomist Antonio Benedetti, whom you see there, right? The text there. So the passage under discussion in Leonid Cheno's chapter is found in Benedetti's Anatomice, and it says, there's a passage there, two little canals come together from the throat. One is shorter and exterior. It is called trachea, trachean arteria, or rough artery, or pharynx. The Latins call it guttur, or spiritual pipe. The second canal is longer and on the interior. The Greeks call it esophagus and stomach. The Latins gullet and sibal fistula, of which I shall speak shortly. So this is a passage by Benedict. So something called Leonid Cheno, attracted Leonid Cheno's attention here. Honestly, the anatomy of the neck, including the pharynx, the larynx, the trachea, and the esophagus, is very complex, even by modern standards, right? We had heard something about the production of voice, the larynx, just previously. So it's a very complex mechanism and anatomical part of the body. Leonicino's critique, however, was not only justified, but also correct. In his analysis, he identified Benedetti's error. What Benedetti had done, he had conflated the trachea and the pharynx, as they were the same thing. To support his argument, Leonicino cites the authority of Galen, the Greek source of medical knowledge, and he notes a series of passages where Galen, correctly identifies the pharynx. Although it is true that even in Greek, in classical or post-classical Greek, pharynx was also used in a bit of a confused manner. So it was not always well distinguished from the larynx. So obviously Benedetti's error was in a way admissible, but it was justified, right? But what I'm interested here is that Leonicino, who was a physician, right, seems to be able to identify what today we refer to as the pharynx, right? Because he says, at the end of this discussion, he says, the pharynx is the place to which both the summit of the trachea and the esophagus reach. So this is a very similar understanding of what the pharynx is now, okay? Again, and I'm gonna finish in a minute. So the anatomy of the neck is very complicated. There were many discussions in the subsequent years and decades. So for example, Berengario da Carpi, in his Commentaria, which was a commentary on Mundinus' Anatomia, devotes several passages to discussing the anatomy of the neck and the throat, noting the different terminology and taking issue with Leonicino. He says that Leonicino was wrong, okay? And there's a citation there. His attack on Leonicino was unjustified because, as we think today, Leonicino was right. In the same section of his work, however, Berengario advises his readers to take note of the essential characteristics of the parts described rather than the names, the multiplicity of names given to them as an anatomist. And this is also true of Niccolò Massa in his Liber Introductorius Anatomiae, who was a dissector and a physician, and he replicates Berengario's observations on the terminological confusions regarding the throat. And I just translate very briefly. Also toward the mouth, where there is that part called the pharynx. In the study of this pharynx, modern scholars struggle, at times criticizing one ancient author, at times another, for not naming all the parts with their proper names, not consider that different languages change names over time. But it should be enough for them to recognize the parts of the body, their locations, substance, and functions by those names, whatever they may be. Nor do I wish to be criticized by hostile individuals if I have sometimes coined a name to clarify a concept, as I acknowledge having done this following Galen's teaching, right? So here you see that this discussion about terminology continued, and it was actually never resolved, right? Well, just the conclusion. The two examples discussed in this presentation illustrate the codependence of linguistic and empirical investigations, as well as a productive role of translation in this process. The case of the term urinarius highlights how a hapax in a translation by Filelfo, possibly the first manuscript attestation, we still have to do more research, was eventually adopted by medical humanists translating Greek authors. Disseminated through the printing press, the term rapidly gained standardized use to designate the urinary ducts, meatus urinarius, particularly the ureters and the urethra. Over time, it was increasingly used to describe the urinary organs more broadly in later works, and was eventually incorporated into the vernacular languages. The spread of this term, together with new anatomical discoveries, may have eventually facilitated a cognitive shift that enabled the conceptualization of excretory parts as a functional whole, what is now known as the urinary system. The case of the pharynx further demonstrates how philological inquiries by university-trained physicians contributed not only to the refinement of medical terminology through carefully interlingual analysis, but also to the advancement of anatomical knowledge. What began as a linguistic puzzle ultimately led to the accurate identification of an anatomical structure of the neck, the pharynx, within the intricate anatomy of the human body. This case underscores the extent to which terminological precision is intimately linked to empirical observations and emphasizes the interdependency of both approaches in the advancement of medical knowledge. And finally, my paper highlights this flawed dichotomy, right, between linguistics and empirical advancements in medicine. As demonstrated by Beaver-Zalian anatomy, the development of medical terminology occurred alongside empirical discoveries and observations. So rather than mutually exclusive, as traditionally believed, both methods of inquiry, in my mind, were interdependent, right? And they're still interdependent. Okay, thank you.